at least the day before. All right, so let us continue. Let me just mention that if you are here today for the first time, please sign in that sheet with your name and email address so that I can create an emailing list for everybody. Okay. Today we will continue with a taste of quantum fields. We are still following quite closely the book by Mukhanov and Vinitsky that is on the list of literature. And that book is also, at this point, starting out with a taste of quantum fields. The idea is to give you an idea of what's going to come up, not yet in detail, but just to give you an overall view, roughly, of how quantum field theory works. So a taste of quantum fields, we start today. And I think in the next lecture, I will show you already how you can calculate quantum fluctuations of fields. In quantum field theory, we deal with wave phenomena. Of course, we also deal with particles. And this is the traditional view of quantum field theory courses that focus on accelerator physics. But quantum field theory is also about fields, fields that propagate like waves. And in the context of the physics of the vacuum, the physics of quantum fluctuations, the physics of horizons and curvature and the production of fluctuations and particles through expansion, for that physics, it is useful to think of quantum field theory from the point of view of waves. Not always. We will spend a lot of time also on particle production. But the wave perspective will become relatively important. Now, waves are ultimately oscillating at amplitudes. In fact, mostly they are harmonically oscillating amplitudes. So somewhere in the mathematics of this, we should expect harmonic oscillators to come up and quantized harmonic oscillators at that. So what we'll do now is to follow this schedule today. First, we recall a few basic facts about harmonic oscillators, classic and quantum, and fluctuations of, and what are quantum fluctuations in harmonic oscillators. Then we'll look at relativistic fields. We will cover the question how you go from the Schrödinger equation to a covariant equation. And then we study the basics of second quantization, which will amount to studying harmonic oscillators, which will amount to studying the harmonic oscillators that are governing the wave phenomena in fields. And the phenomenon of quantum fluctuations in harmonic oscillators will translate relatively straightforwardly into the phenomenon of vacuum fluctuations of fields. Not only vacuum fluctuations, just generally quantum fluctuations of fields. All right, so since quantum harmonic oscillators are going to be so important in field theory, it is worth looking at them from a suitable perspective, again, just in isolation. What do harmonic oscillators do classically, and what's the difference in quantum mechanics? Classically, the Hamiltonian of a harmonic oscillator looks like this. Mu stands for the mass. And the equations of motion of the harmonic oscillator look like that. You know, the usual equations, p dot is equal to a constant times q. This is the back driving force, which is proportional to the elongation of the harmonic oscillator. And this equation here, which expresses the momentum in terms of the time derivative, is often viewed as a definition. But in the context of quantum theory, it is more natural to view this as an equation of motion as well, simply because it's also an equation that involves time derivatives. Now, what is the lowest energy solution of a harmonic oscillator? This question is going to be important in the context of quantum field theory, because the lowest energy state, at least on Minkowski space, is the state of lowest energy. Later, we will find that if the space-time is expanding, then the lowest energy state is not the vacuum state in general. But for now, in the first approximation, when we're dealing just with Minkowski space, the lowest energy state will coincide with the vacuum state. And it will be governed by the lowest energy states of harmonic oscillators, as we will soon see. So let us now already ask, what do the lowest energy solutions look like for a harmonic oscillator, or the lowest energy solution? Well, if it's a classical harmonic oscillator, it's pretty trivial. The lowest energy state is when the thing is sitting at the bottom and not moving at all. So Q of t, the position as a function of time is zero, the momentum as a function of time is also zero, the energy as a function of time is also always zero and stays zero. We can summarize this the situation by saying nothing moves, and we are certain about that. Okay? Now, the situation when we look at the real life situation where everything is quantized looks like this. In order to describe it, we, as always when quantizing, keep the Hamiltonian and the equations of motion completely unchanged. So we had this expression for the Hamiltonian, and we had these expressions for the equations of motion. We will keep them completely unchanged. In the Heisenberg picture, this is how you can always do it. So the Hamiltonian reads like this, and the only difference is now that I've put hats on the variables to indicate that it's going to be quantum theory here. But the equation looks formally just the same. Also, the equations of motion are unchanged. Quantum theory comes in through the quantization condition that the commutation relations between Q and P are non-trivial in this way, which of course means that the functions Q of t, Q hat of t, and P hat of t can no longer be number valued. They have to take values in some mathematical entities that are non-commutative. One can show that they can take values in matrices or operators if they are represented on an infinite dimensional space. And any such representation is equivalent to any other with some small qualifications. So Q hat of t and P hat of t and H hat are operator value. Oh, by the way, let me just ask you whether you are aware of that. You know, all we need to do in order to go from the classical harmonic oscillator to the quantum harmonic oscillator is to ensure that this equation still hold, plus that commutation relation. Now, couldn't it be that somebody who's really clever comes up with a solution where Q hat of t and P hat of t are not operators on an infinite dimensional space, but on a finite dimensional space? Could that be? I mean, after all, angular momentum, for example, also obeys non-trivial commutation relations. And we know that angular momentum can be represented on finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, spin, for example. So how do we know that these guys have to be operators? How do we know that they have to act on infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces? Any ideas there? Exactly. Take the trace of that equation, and you find that the trace of the right-hand side is IH bar times the trace of 1. But the trace of 1 is the dimension of the vector space. On the left-hand side, you have to take a trace of the commutator, but the trace of a commutator is vanishing, because the trace of AB is the trace of BA if you're dealing with finite dimensional matrices. So what you have is that the trace of the left-hand side in finite dimensional vector spaces is always 0, and the trace of the right-hand side in finite dimensional Hilbert spaces is always IH bar times n, the dimension. This is a contradiction, and therefore there is no finite dimension representation of this. Therefore, it's justified to speak, of operators. Of course, that doesn't guarantee that you can do it with operators, but we know, of course, we can do it with operators. For example, Q can be represented as a multiplication operator, P as a differentiation operator. Okay. Now, let's come back to the physics of this. For a quantum harmonic oscillator, what is the lowest energy solution now? Well, the lowest energy state shall be denoted by psi naught. And I will not go through the complete calculations. I'm sure you've seen that many times. What you find is that the lowest energy eigenstate of the Hamiltonian has an eigenvalue E naught, which turns out to be 1/2 h bar omega, omega being the natural frequency of the harmonic oscillator. One thing we realize with this is that the lowest energy of the quantum harmonic oscillator is elevated over the energy of the classical harmonic oscillator. It had lowest energy 0, whereas the quantum harmonic oscillator has lowest energy 1/2 h bar omega. How can we understand that this is so? Later on, this elevation of the ground state energy will turn out to be the cosmological constant, because quantum fields consist of lots of harmonic oscillators, each one having this 1/2 h bar omega. Quantum fields, even in the vacuum, even in the lowest energy state, have a lot of energy. In principle, infinitely much. And that's a problem of the cosmological constant that we will come back to later on. But for now, let's just say, OK, for one single quantum harmonic oscillator, the lowest energy is elevated. And we expect that this has an impact on quantum fields, namely that for them, the lowest energy state might also not be of zero energy. So what, again, is the lowest energy state of a quantum harmonic oscillator? Consider the eigenbasis, the position eigenbasis. So it's the eigenbasis of the position operator. If you apply the position operator on one of its eigenvectors, you get the eigenvalue, which is a position for Q running through all real numbers. And we normalize those position eigenvectors according to a continuum normalization. Then the ground state of the harmonic oscillator, psi naught, which is an abstract vector in the Hilbert space, has the following position wave function. Remember that the position wave function of any arbitrary state in the Hilbert space, so the psi naught of Q wave function, is simply the state inner product taken with the position eigenvector. If you calculate that, you find that the ground state of the harmonic oscillator has this form. It's a Gaussian. Roughly, it's a constant times e to the power of minus q squared. This curve is going to play a role in quantum field theory as well, because it's governed by harmonic oscillators. So what does that mean? The classical harmonic oscillator in its ground state, in its lowest energy state, was simply sitting, it was resting at the position q equals 0. Does the quantum harmonic oscillator do this as well? Well, let's calculate what the position expectation value is for the in the ground state if the harmonic oscillator is in its ground state. Well, the position expectation value, q bar, you will put bars on operators when we take the expectation value, is calculated this way. You know, the state, the observable, the state, we integrate this over. And since the Gaussian is an even function, we have an even function here, an even function there, the q makes it an odd function. So without doing the integral, we already know that it will be 0. So the position expectation value is still 0, just as it was for the classical harmonic oscillator. However, there are quantum fluctuations. And we can calculate them, their amount, by calculating the standard deviation in the position measurement. Remember that just because the expectation value of the position is 0, it doesn't mean that when you measure the position, you find that they always find 0. can find all sorts of values. And if you do an ensemble of measurements, then while the mean value is zero, the distribution will have some spread. It will have some standard deviation. And the usual way to calculate the standard deviation is this. You take the operator minus the expectation value. This is the deviation from the mean, which could be positive or negative. Since we're not interested in whether the deviation is positive or negative, but just whether there is a deviation, we square that to get something positive, always in each case. And then we take the absolute, we take the expectation value of the squared distance from the mean, take the square root of that, and that's the standard deviation. If you do it for the Gaussian, if you do that for the ground state of the quantum harmonic oscillator, you find that this is the standard deviation. I'm recording all those things. I know that you've seen those things before, but we will need all those expressions later on when we deal with quantum fields. Because there again, this will play a role telling us how much the quantum field will fluctuate. So you should not think of this as the harmonic oscillator doing necessarily funny stuff. It just means that if we have an ensemble of measurements, then we will have an ensemble of outcomes, and that's just the standard deviation. Since the harmonic oscillator, according to that result, is generally elevated, it's generally, sorry, elongated, it's generally not at the zero position, it's clear that it's somewhere up the potential hill and generally has some momentum as well. And that's the reason why the ground state energy is elevated. Because generally, the quantum harmonic oscillator is not close to the lowest point. It's generally at an elevated point. All right, so we've recalled harmonic oscillators. Let us look at relativistic fields now. Here the question is, how can we make the Schrödinger equation relativistically covariant? Remember this notation here, this is the Laplacian. If you spell it out, it is the sum of the squared spatial derivatives on flat space. Dirac found a way to make this covariant, and Klein-Gordon found a way to make this covariant. Let us look at how Klein and Gordon did that. Klein and Gordon said, well, what's really in this Schrödinger equation? What does it really mean, the Schrödinger equation? Well, it just translated it back into the variables that into those variables that came from the classical mechanical description. See, the momentum in quantum mechanics in the position representation, this is the Schrödinger equation in the position representation, the momentum is always minus I h bar d by dx, which is to say that what we have here on the right-hand side is simply the sum of the squares of the momentum. On the other hand, the left-hand side is the energy. Okay? So in quantum mechanics, the energy is I h bar d by dt, which is to say that the Schrödinger equation is really just expressing this. If we do not choose a representation, here we've chosen the position representation. We could have chosen the momentum representation. We could have chosen a Fock basis representation or any other basis we like. If we do not choose a basis, then we can abstractly always write the Schrödinger equation in this way. E psi is p squared over 2m psi. Which is true for all the psi that obey the Schrödinger equation. So really, the Schrödinger equation expresses simply that the energy of a, I mean, this is the free Schrödinger equation. And what it expresses is that for a free particle, the energy is p squared over 2m. That's all it says. Or in other words, it means that the energy is 1 half m the velocity squared, which is clearly not a covariant thing to say. But what would be the covariant thing to say, classically? Well, special relativity tells us that this is a valid equation. Namely that the energy squared minus the momentum squared is m squared c squared. This is just the square of the four momentum vector. It's equal to m squared c to the fourth. So if we now use the way that in quantum mechanics the momentum and the energy are represented when you choose the position basis and when you choose the time basis. You see, you could also Fourier transform this and it would be just the energy. When you choose those representations in quantum mechanics, then you have this way of translating, of representing your operators. Then out of this kinematical equation, you obtain this equation as a generalization of the Schrödinger equation. And that is the Klein-Gordon equation for a free particle. Simply, E is replaced by, or is it's not replaced, but represented by the time derivative, or I times the time derivative, and P as usual as minus I times the space derivative. Okay, so here we have the Klein-Gordon equation, which is usually expressed in this form. Where the units are chosen such that velocities are measured as multiples of the speed of light, and actions are measured as multiples of h bar. And an even shorter way of writing the Klein-Gordon equation is to write it as box plus m squared of on psi is equal to zero, where we've introduced the box operator, that's the so-called Dannenberg operator, which is the second time derivative minus the Laplacian on Minkowski space. In curved space, it will, of course, be a more general expression. Now, let us see whether we recover the non-relativistic limit. By the way, when we do that, we will also recover E equal mc squared, of course. I mean, you may have seen it in this way. But now we will recover E is equal to mc squared. And along the way, we will see how the Schrödinger equation arises from the Klein-Gordon equation. So how do we recover the Schrödinger equation? We must show that the Klein-Gordon equation reduces to the Schrödinger equation when the momenta are small, or equivalently, when we assume that the speed of light is very high. So let us assume the Klein-Gordon equation. So we assume that this holds. We don't write it out in the position and time representation. We write it abstractly, just like in classical mechanics. So we assume the Klein-Gordon equation, E squared over C squared is this. The only difference to what we had the slide above is that the P squared is now on the right-hand side, whereas we used to have it on the left-hand side. Now we take the square root of this, and we obtain that the energy is plus or minus that square root. We have a choice here, plus or minus. Turns out that essentially that's a choice between particles and antiparticles. You will choose the positive energy solutions for obvious reasons, because we know that the Schrödinger particles will have positive energy. But the issue of negative energies comes up, of course, in quantum field theory later on. So let us now do a Taylor expansion of this expression of the energy in terms of the momentum and the mass. Now, how shall we do the Taylor expansion? What is small in this? What do we assume small? Well, we assume that the particle is not moving very fast, which is to say that this term is assumed to be small compared to that one. You see, here we have a p squared, c squared, and here we have an mc squared times c squared. So here's a c squared, here's a c to the fourth, which is to say that this p squared is competing with the c squared. All right, so we do a Taylor expansion for small for small p squared. And then what we obtain is that the lowest order term is when p is equal to 0. I mean, we are expanding around p squared equal to 0. And the lowest order term is e equal to square root of m squared c to the fourth, which is to say that e is equal to mc squared. And then the next order term is this one, which we have to evaluate. Just, you know, take the derivative and then use the chain rule. So we get this term, which we have to evaluate at p squared equal to 0, plus higher order terms that arise from the second derivative with respect to p vector squared. OK, so this term here reduces simply to p squared over 2m. And then there are higher order terms. The next term would be proportional to p vector to the fourth power. And what we recognize here is that the expansion gives us, first of all, the rest energy of a particle, plus what from classical mechanics we recognize as the kinetic energy, 1/2 mv squared. And then there are other terms, proportional to the velocity to the fourth power. Right, so we've not quite recovered the Schrödinger equation, because while we can drop this term here, it's higher order. Okay, we are assuming that p squared is very small, so we are assuming that this is negligible. But we have this thing here, the rest energy. Other than that, we have the Schrödinger equation. The Schrödinger equation is E equal to p squared over 2m. What about that term here? Well, let's see. For small momenta, what we've just derived is that the Klein-Gödel equation becomes the Schrödinger equation with this extra term here, mc squared. Or, once we use that E is represented as ih body by dt, and p is represented as minus ih body by dx, we obtain this Schrödinger equation here with an extra term. And the term is not small. The rest energy of an electron is 1/2 MeV, which is tremendous. Now, if this is our new Hamiltonian here, for the free particle, p squared over 2m, as usual in the Schrödinger equation, plus mc squared, why is it irrelevant? I mean, it better be irrelevant, but why is it irrelevant in quantum mechanics? Yeah?
Equations of motion only take into account that it's a constant, and so the equations of motion will be the same.
Yes, that it's a constant is good, but the point is it's multiplied with the identity. As an operator, it's multiplied with the identity, which means that in commutators it drops out. So let us look at the quantum mechanical equations of motion. In the Heisenberg picture, which is what we've been using here, or what we will be using mostly, and one of the instances, one of the ways we see that it is very useful is to apply it in this case. In the Heisenberg picture, the time evolution of any observable f hat, which could be q or p or h or the angular momentum or whatever observable you like, the differential equation governing the evolution of any arbitrary observable in the Heisenberg picture is, of course, and I'm assuming you know that, is governed by this equation here, which is ih body by dt f hat is equal to the commutator of f hat, f being the arbitrary observable, with the Hamiltonian. But you see, when you add a constant times the identity, and it doesn't really have to be constant for this argument, if you add to the Hamiltonian anything that's a multiple of the identity, then it will drop out in the commutator, because f hat will commute with anything that's multiple of the identity, and therefore the equation of motion is really insensitive to any multiple of the identity in the Hamiltonian, which explains why in early quantum mechanics we got away with neglecting this term. But of course, in the Klein-Gödel equation, it's built into it, and it will not be neglected. I have here some comments on the site in case you're interested. But I will not go into the details because I'm spelling out the details here pretty much. Think about it, it's not quite trivial that the Schrödinger equation should arise from the Klein-Gordon equation. The reason being that the Schrödinger equation always has solutions that are complex value. Right? Because you have I, the complex unit, occurring prominently on the left-hand side. It's the very first symbol in the Schrödinger equation. Whereas the Klein-Gordon equation doesn't have that in it. Which is to say that, yes, there are complex solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, but you can always write them as a purely real plus a purely imaginary solution. The real part and the imaginary part completely decoupled there. And I'm discussing here that issue. And one thing that you can convince yourself of pretty straightforwardly is that if you have a solution of the Schrödinger equation, then it will also obey the Klein-Gordon equation in the appropriate approximation. But I leave it up to you to figure it out exactly how that works. Here is an explanation. I mean, all you have to do is read it, but you have to do something. I won't spell it out all. Some remarks. The negative energy solutions that are clearly present in the Klein-Gordon equation that we have thrown away when we reduce the Klein-Gordon equation to the Schrödinger equation, those negative energy solutions that are always present in the Klein-Gordon equation are spoiling the interpretation of psi of x and t as a probability amplitude density. So the Klein-Gordon equation's solutions, psi of x and t, unfortunately cannot be interpreted as simply being the probability amplitude for finding a particle here at x, at time t. It just isn't. And the reason can be traced to the fact that we've thrown away something when we went to the Schrödinger equation where that interpretation holds. That we've thrown away those negative energy solutions. Now, ultimately, the reason is that why this is not fixable within just the Klein-Gordon equation, the reason is that what is positive energy or negative energy, or what is positively what is propagating forward in time or propagating backward in time, is not a covariant thing in general. Ultimately, this is because there are events whose sequence of occurrence is not a Lorentz invariant entity, namely events that are space-like separated from another, are always occurring in one sequence for some observers and in the other sequence for other observers, which is to say that what seems to be propagating forward in time for one observer seems to be propagating backward in time for another observer. Physically, you don't have stuff that's propagating faster than the speed of light over space-like separated distances. But the wave function doesn't know that. It does its thing anyway. So the wave equations have this property built into it. So in the particle picture, once you work it out, exactly you find that there's no contradiction to causality in this. But in the wave picture, you're stuck with this problem that apparently there are waves propagating faster than the speed of light. And therefore, there's an ambiguity in what is a particle and what is an antiparticle. And that means that with the means of the Schrödinger equation, you can't handle the Klein-Gordon equation. It's just not interpretable in the same way that the Schrödinger equation would be. You have to go to the full quantum field theory to find out how to interpret what are real probability amplitudes. And the psi of x and t are not going to be real probability amplitudes or complex probability amplitudes the way that the Schrödinger amplitudes are. Yep. There are two answers to this. One is no, and the other one is yes. The answer is no, because the Hamiltonian is a first order time derivative, and the energy is a first order time derivative. The Pythagorean equation is second time derivative. So the answer there is no. You would have to have the Hamiltonian squared, or the energy squared. However, as we will see a little later, the thing is that we can look at the Pythagorean equation differently. Namely, from a second quantization point of view, we can say, what is the Pythagorean equation anyway? It's just an equation of motion. Just like the equation of motion of the harmonic oscillator or any other equation of motion. We can ask, as an equation of motion, can it be generated by a Hamiltonian? And the answer to that would be yes. But it will be a Hamiltonian that's totally different from the Hamiltonian of a Schrödinger equation. It's one level of abstraction higher, as you will see. Because the Hamiltonian is not an expression of the Pythagorean equation, it's going to be an expression from which you can derive the Pythagorean equation. In the same way, by the way, the Schrödinger equation also has a Hamiltonian from which it can be derived. And that's not at all the Hamiltonian on the left-hand side of the Schrödinger. As we will see, maybe we're just jumping ahead. Okay. So the second comment, 1b. As I said, this problem is deep, the issue with the negative energies, but it can be solved within quantum field theory by requiring that negative energy particles propagate backwards in time, positive energy particles propagate forward in time. But it's too early to discuss that. Now, there are actually many ways to generalize the Schrödinger equation to obtain a relativistically covariant equation. There's the Klein-Gordon method to do it, but then there's also Dirac's method to do it. And there are many more ways. There are many, many more ways to write down equations of motion for fields, equations of motions of motion that are covariant, that are Lorentz symmetric. And the question arose in the 1940s, or even earlier, at least in one person's mind, namely Wigner's mind, the question arose, well, if we have lots of them, and in the literature more and more had appeared, then how do we know which are the right ones? And so he asked, can we group them in equivalence classes? And he thought about this really hard and published his results, and as a result was fired from Princeton because they didn't appreciate his work. It took a few years, and then they appreciated, wanted to hire him back, and he said, no, he wants to be the These are the dangers of being ahead of your time. Anyway, what he found was that equations of motion, covariant equations of motion, can be put into equivalence classes. There are equations of motion for particles of spin zero, and it turns out that they're all equivalent to the Klein-Gordon equation. And examples of particles that can be described with the Klein-Gordon equation are the Higgs particle, which we hope will be observed by the LHC at CERN, hopefully soon. The inflaton particle, which we don't really see as a particle, but we have good evidence that it exists. At least that the Klein-Gordon fields exist that describe that inflaton particle. Those would be probably fundamental particles that are not decomposable into more basic units. They are truly elementary. At least that's the assumption nowadays, that the Higgs and the inflaton particles are elementary. But then there are also non-elementary particles that are scalar, that are spin zero, such as pions. That are made out of two quarks, some pions anyway. But then there are other equations of motion. For example, the Dirac equation is a relativistically covariant wave equation for spin 1/2 particles. And actually I should say there's a Dirac equation and there's a Weyl equation. And the Dirac equation is made out of Weyl equations. And the completely correct statement is that all of the spin 1/2 particles are made out of particles that obey this Weyl equation. particles that can be described in this way are all the spin half particles, such as electrons, quarks, protons, neutrons, neutrinos, and so on. And again, Wigner clarified that whatever you come up with, if it's correct, it's equivalent to this Dirac or Weyl equation. And then he looked at spin one particles. They obey the Maxwell equations, and all spin one half relativistically covariant wave equations are equivalent to the Maxwell equations, or more generally, really, the Maxwell-Yang-Mills equations. Examples of these are photons, gluons, etc. How about higher spin particles? In principle, Wigner's analysis goes on. You can have particles of any spin. But the trouble is that we don't seem to need them and don't seem to be able to handle them either. On one hand, we have never observed elementary particles that would have a spin larger than one. Sure, you can have particles that have a spin much larger than one, but they are not elementary particles. For example, if you spin around your own axis, you are a sort of a particle with a large spin. Or if you take a nucleus of some atom, it can have a big spin, no doubt about it, in a double digit easily. But they are not elementary. They can be decomposed further. And on the other hand, curiously, it can be shown that when you have particles of spin larger than one, then our current methods of dealing with the divergences of quantum field theory fail. And we do not expect that regular quantum field theory can handle the description of those particles. So that's an interesting observation, that even though in principle arbitrary spins are possible, nature doesn't seem to make use of them in elementary particles. And on the other hand, quantum field theory doesn't seem to be able to describe them either. There's only one dark spot in this argumentation, which is that the particles that the conjectured particles that should correspond to gravity, the gravitons, would have to be spin two particles. In violation of all of this, it would seem that we can't handle them with quantum field theory, and, well, we haven't seen them either. All right. So in our schedule, we've covered harmonic oscillators and their quantum fluctuations. We looked at relativistic fields. And now let's look at second quantization. We will hear in this course second quantize only the Klein-Gordon equation. Could be done for the Dirac equation and other equations. But the phenomena that we are interested here in, the phenomena of quantum fluctuations, particle creation in the presence of horizons and expanding spacetimes, are pretty similar, no matter which fields you are looking at, whether it's photons or electrons or Klein-Gordon particles. So let us separate the different technical issues. If you deal with particles described by the Dirac equation or by the Maxwell equation, then you have to handle spin as well, which means that you have to carry around a lot of indices at the very least. And once you describe them on curved space, it's really much harder to deal with them properly because you have to work with the formalism of frames and so on. So let us leave the issue of spin aside and look at just scalar particles. That's the easiest. And they already capture the essence of what can happen when space is expanding and you have horizons. And indeed, luckily, the only experimentally significant situations are those with scalars, those with spin zero particles. In cosmology, only in cosmology do we have a chance of observing the quantum fluctuation amplification that comes from expanding spacetimes. And as far as we understand so far, only scalar fields, only those with spin zero, will contribute observationally. So we are really not missing out by focusing on the spin zero case. All right, from now on, we will switch notation from the psi that was Schrödinger equation inspired to phi, just to conform with the usual notation for scalar particles. And instead of calling it a wave function, which it really isn't after second quantization, we will just call it a field. We start with an important definition now for second quantization. We define a canonically conjugate field to our field phi. So phi is the primary degree of freedom here. It's the thing that came out of the Schrödinger equation, if you like. Phi of x and t is what obeys the Schrödinger obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. And now we define a conjugate field for it. Just like for the position operator, we define its canonically conjugate variable, the momentum operator. Here, in field theory, for second quantization, we take the field and define for it its momentum field, its canonically conjugate field, namely the time derivative. Just like for the position operator, we had its time derivative being up to a constant. The momentum operator here, the momentum field is up to a constant, in this case, z equal 1, just the time derivative of phi. So the dot on top of a variable denotes time derivative. So this is analogous to p equal q dot. And there are two or three of you here today who went here in the last lectures. Let me just say one sentence to why we do this. Heisenberg had this idea. He said that in quantum mechanics, everything fluctuates, everything is uncertain, except for one thing, and that is the wave function. It is evolving deterministically. How unquantum mechanical is this? that the wave function is evolving completely deterministically according to the Schrödinger equation and is not subject to fluctuations. So he suggested second quantization, meaning we consider the wave function itself as a dynamical entity that has a canonical conjugate momentum and suitable commutation relations between the wave function and its canonically conjugate momentum, which will ensure that there's an uncertainty relation between the field and the canonically conjugate field. And that uncertainty relation will ensure that there are quantum fluctuations. OK, so here's the first step in this. We introduce a canonically conjugate field. Using that field, we can rewrite the Klein-Gordon equation in this way. Trivially, you see pi is already the first derivative of phi, first time derivative. If you put another dot on it, it's the second time derivative of phi, minus the Laplacian, which is the sum of second space derivatives, plus m squared is equal to 0. OK, so that's just another way of writing the Klein-Gordon equation now. And here are the quantization conditions. Yeah, keep in mind that in quantum mechanics, as always, in the Heisenberg picture, we can keep the equations of motion in this way, in this case, this one, completely the same. We're not changing the equations of motion. This equation will be maintained, the Klein-Gordon equation. The only thing that makes it quantum is that we impose non-trivial commutation relations between the degrees of freedom and the conjugate momenta. And that's what we do here. We take the field and postulates that it doesn't commute with its canonically conjugate momentum field. This equation is completely analogous to this equation in first quantization. See, in first quantization, in regular quantum mechanics, what you have is that there are several position operators, at least three for the three space directions. And if you have several particles, you can have if you have n particles, you have three n position operators. Let's just label the position operators by A. A running 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. Let's say it's one particle. Then we have just A running from 1 to 3. So we have three position operators, QA. And we have their three momentum operators, P, A prime. And they are non-commutative only for their respective partners. Q1 will commute with P2, etc. Qi only is non-commutative with PR. Similarly here, while the Q is labeled by A, the phi is labeled by X. So for every X, and the X is running, of course, through a continuum of values, for every X, we have another operator phi hat. Just like for every A, we have another operator Q hat. Here we have for every X, another operator phi hat. And also for every X prime, we have another operator pi hat. So we have a continuum of operators phi hat, and also continuously infinitely many operators pi hat. Generally, they're always commuting with another, except that a phi at X, a phi with the index X, is non-commuting with a pi with the index X prime when it's equal to X. We express this through this commutation relation here, where this is the Dirac delta here. This, as I explained last time already, has to be smeared out in order to make well-defined. But it's a compact way of writing what we mean. The phi all commute with another, independent of their label X, and the pi commute with another. So the situation is that the postulate here is that at every point in space is a degree of freedom phi, just like a position operator. Or momentum, or an angular momentum operator. It's an operator. At every point in space, there sits an operator which acts on Hilbert space, an operator which we will call phi hat. And this operator has a canonically conjugate pi hat. And those operators are functions of time in the Heisenberg picture. We keep, as we said before, we keep the equations of motion. So we keep this equation here, namely that phi hat dot is pi hat. Pi hat. And this equation, which is simply the Klein-Gordon equation. This equation is analogous to that equation here, q dot is p. Remember that we have lots of q hats labeled by A. We have lots of phi hats, in this case labeled by X. But other than that, these two equations are very analogous to another. And the Klein-Gordon equation, looks a little bit like the harmonic oscillator equation from this perspective. Because here what we have is the second time derivative of phi, or the first time derivative of p, of pi in this case, first time derivative of pi, is equal to something, just some blob. We will later see what exactly is going on in there. Some blob times phi. Something times phi. So we have that p dot is something times phi, or minus something times phi. Let us look at the equation of the harmonic oscillator. For the harmonic oscillator, we have that p hat dot. So not pi hat dot, but p hat dot is equal to minus something times q hat. And it's the same index A here as is over there. So what we see is that the harmonic oscillator of first quantization of the Schrödinger equation, regular simple harmonic oscillator, has this property that the time derivative of the momentum is minus a constant times the position, or elongation. And here, it looks similar. The time derivative of the momentum is minus something times the elongation, so to speak, the phi. But this something is just not a number. How bad, right? Wouldn't it be nice if it were a number? As it is, it's not a number. And the interpretation of that can be figured out quite easily. You see, what it means is that those harmonic oscillators, and I'm using the plural because for every value of A, we have another harmonic oscillator, those harmonic oscillators are decoupled from another, whereas those guys are not. See, what happens here is that for every value of A, you have a harmonic oscillator, which you can solve not caring about the other harmonic oscillator. They're completely independent of another. The equation for A equal 1 doesn't have anything occurring with A equal 2 or 3. Completely independent. These harmonic oscillators are independent. Here, however, you see that what pi at dot is depends not only, well, with the label x, depends not only what the phi with label x does, it depends also on what the derivative of phi is. So in other words, this time derivative will depend on the derivative of this as well, which is to say that that the harmonic oscillator at x depends also on what the harmonic oscillators in the neighborhood are doing. The derivative knows what the neighborhood is like. I mean, in the infinitesimal neighborhood is like. Okay? I mean, if this thing were 0, it would be just one harmonic oscillator for each label x, which would be a very easy situation. You would simply be able to say that at every point in space sits a harmonic oscillator that oscillates independently of any other harmonic oscillator. That would be the case if this was 0. Okay? But it's not, which is to say that the harmonic oscillator here is affected by its infinitesimal neighborhood because of that derivative here. Does that mean that in quantum field theory, we will have to deal with coupled harmonic oscillators all the time? No? How is there a way to get rid of this headache that this thing is a derivative? Wouldn't it be so nice? It would be so nice, right? If that weren't the derivative, but just some fixed number here, then we would have a complete equivalence or analogy between this set of harmonic oscillators and those. The only difference would be that here we have a continuum of harmonic oscillators. For each value of x, we have a harmonic oscillator, and x is running through R3. And here we have a set of harmonic oscillators where A is running through integers. But other than that, it would be exactly the same. Now, is there a way, perhaps, to turn this Laplacian into a number? Any idea? Yeah, exactly. Fourier transform. Right? If we Fourier transform this entire equation, then we pay a price, but we gain something very important, too. If we Fourier transform that equation, then instead of phi hat of x and t, and we Fourier transform with respect to the position variables, then we end up with phi hat of p vector of t. Right? Instead of x, we get p. Or, yeah, let's call it p. Okay. And the Laplacian turns into k squared. So we can predict what we have to do. We just have to Fourier transform this equation. And then we have here pi hat dot of k and t, k vector and t, is equal to minus k squared plus m squared phi hat of k and t. And those harmonic oscillators, the harmonic oscillators in momentum space, will be independent harmonic oscillators. So what that tells us is that while it is true that we can think of having one harmonic oscillator at every point in space, those harmonic oscillators are coupled to another. But if we look at momentum space, then we have also one harmonic oscillator at every point in momentum space. But those harmonic oscillators are uncoupled from another. They are decoupled from another. And physically, this is completely plausible. Because what does that mean? What does it mean that you have, what does it mean momentum space? It means you've chosen a wavelength. Chosen a wavelength. A wavelength. So if one of those harmonic oscillators is excited, the harmonic oscillator is in Wenton space in Higgs. It means you have a wave which has a particular wavelength, wave vector k. And that this wave is decoupled from the others is clear. Because if you have a wave, be it sound or a Klein-Gordon wave, if you have a wave which is just one wave vector, just one k vector, then its time evolution is such that it just keeps that wave. It's not going to create excitations of other wavelengths. If you have just a simple wave equation like the Klein-Gordon equation, then if you start up with a wave of a particular wavelength, all it will do is oscillate. It will not excite other wavelengths. It will not excite oscillators of other wavelengths. Whereas if you look at the harmonic oscillators in position space, it's clear that if you excite one harmonic oscillator at one point in position space, then it will start exciting all the neighboring ones, and they will excite their neighboring ones, and so on. So you have a wave spreading out. But in momentum space, it's just one. All the harmonic oscillators are independent. All the wavelengths are oscillating independently. You can also anticipate, perhaps, from this perspective, what you will see happen when the space-time is expanding. When the space-time is expanding, this little trick will not work anymore. Cannot work anymore. We can't see that mathematically now, but intuitively you can see why not. It's because in an expanding space-time, if you start out with a wave of wavelength 5 meters, then a day later, this wavelength is going to be larger. Okay? Because if space is expanding, waves are being stretched. For example, the cosmic microwave background now has mostly a wavelength in the microwave region. But wait a few billion years, and it's going to have a much longer wavelength, just because of the expansion of the space underneath it. So in other words, when space is expanding, those harmonic oscillators, the momentum space ones, will become coupled. They will have to be coupled because the harmonic oscillator of wavelength that corresponds to waves of wavelength 5 meters is initially excited, but will lose its excitation. And instead, a harmonic oscillator of a slightly larger wavelength will be excited. And then a little later, it will be unexcited. And a harmonic oscillator corresponding to waves of an even larger wavelength will be excited. So they hand their excitation further on and on. OK, but for now, what we can see is that, for now, this trick will work with the Fourier transform. Now let's come to this question that one of you had about a Hamiltonian for the Klein-Gordon equation. Is there a Hamiltonian for second quantization? We know the Hamiltonian for the Schrödinger equation, but that's first quantization. Is there a Hamiltonian for second quantization? Well, here it is. This Hamiltonian here is the momentum field squared plus the field squared with that expression in the middle here. This is, again, analogous to the Hamiltonian of a sum of harmonic oscillators in ordinary quantum mechanics. In ordinary quantum mechanics, when you have several harmonic oscillators, their Hamiltonians simply add up. So here we have the Hamiltonian of several harmonic oscillators. Now, the claim is, in second quantization, that if you take this Hamiltonian and calculate its commutator with phi, you get phi dot. Remember this equation? Ah, here it is. Remember that in quantum theory, and I'm using the word quantum theory to stress that it's not just quantum mechanics. It's also quantum field theory. And it will probably also hold in quantum gravity. In quantum theory, you always have that IH bar f hat dot is the commutator between f hat and h, the Heisenberg equation of motion. This ought to be true in first quantization as much as in second quantization. All the equations of motion can always be derived in this way. The equations of motion, for example, for the harmonic oscillator. If you take just a few harmonic oscillators, take any one of their variables, such as a position variable, and you want its equation of motion, all you have to do is calculate the commutator between the position variable and the Hamiltonian, namely this one. And then this equation here becomes the equation of motion for Q dot. And similarly, if I want to know what the time derivative of P is, of PA is, just calculate the commutator with H. Easy to verify, just plug in that Hamiltonian into these equations, and you get the usual equations of motion for the harmonic oscillator, for the sum of harmonic oscillators. Here, similarly, the claim is that if you take that Hamiltonian and you plug it into that commutator here, then you get the time derivative of phi hat. So it's another instance of this. As an example of f, of our observable, of our degree of freedom, we are choosing now phi hat. And then the claim is that IH bar phi hat dot is phi hat with H, where H is this Hamiltonian here. How is that going to work? Well, H is this integral here. And you have to put that entire integral into that commutator. So we have to commute the phi hat with this stuff and with that. Now, the commutator between phi hat and this is going to be zero, because all it involves is commutators between phi and phi. But phi always commutes with phi, no matter phi x, phi of x commutes with phi at x prime and so on. So that's not going to contribute. But we also have to take the commutator between phi hat and the pi hat squared. And if you work it out, you will find that, well, we know what the commutator between phi hat and pi hat is. It's the Dirac delta function times IH bar. So we plug that in there. And then the Dirac delta gets eaten up by the integral. And then we obtain the equation of motion for phi hat dot, namely that it is basically pi. And if we do a similar thing here, we find that the pi hat will commute with this piece, all right. But the phi hat will not commute with that. Instead, it will pick up this piece and the factor 2, because the phi comes up twice. And that will give us just the Klein-Gordon equation here, namely pi hat dot equal to this stuff times phi. But please work it out yourself. That's the homework for today. But don't hand it in. Just try. Another thing you may want to try is to calculate the second quantization Hamiltonian for the Schrödinger equation. See, the Schrödinger equation has a Hamiltonian, of course. But that's the first quantization Hamiltonian. I'm talking about the second quantization Hamiltonian. So the second quantization Hamiltonian of the Schrödinger equation is going to be Hamiltonian which has this type of ingredient, pi fields, phi fields. And when you take it and put it in here and there, then you should get here phi hat dot is pi hat. And you should get here the Schrödinger equation. OK? Other than that exercise, remember that the textbook by Mukhanov and Vinitsky also has plenty of exercises, in fact, with solutions in the back. OK, I think we're done for today. Are there any questions? Yep.
I'm just curious. How is The H operator, I'm having a little trouble interpreting what it's doing. So does that come functions on how's the interval really taken before or after I could act on some function or
generally, it is hoped that it doesn't matter. In practice, of course, you can construct situations where it doesn't matter. But it is believed generally that for physical applications, you don't need to worry about it. Because in physics, things are never that, this is hoped, are never that fine-tuned, never that subtle that you have to worry about it. We will, of course, get to this in all detail, how those things will be represented later on. Let me just give you a brief preview of this part. On this side here, on the side of regular quantum mechanics, we have the task of actually solving those equations. And to solve those equations, it is usually necessary to find an explicit representation of those objects. Not always, but most of the time, it is useful to have an explicit representation. So for example, we would represent Q hat as represented as multiplication with x. With x. And then p hat, or well, a, p hat a represented as minus I h bar dxa, for example. And then well, acting on wave functions psi of x, the usual thing. In this way, you can turn an equation, an abstract equation of motion, into a concrete differential equation. Use the methods of differential equations to solve it. Now, the choice of representation is not unique. Doesn't matter. As long as you have a truthful representation here, you can do it. Similarly, here now, we have to find a representation. In quantum mechanics, we represent on wave functions psi of x. We will have to ask, how can we represent the phi hat and the pi hat? What can we represent them on? Remember that we have q hat, p hat a, a, b, equal I h bar delta a, b. And if you just work out whether that's true, you find it is true on wave functions, right? Is represented by x a minus I dxb psi of x minus I dxb xa psi of x equals 0. Right? The reason why this is a good representation of those guys is that indeed they obey the commutation relation. Just by the Leibniz rule. Not equals 0, equal to IH bar psi of x. Right? I mean, you see why that is? It's because when you apply this derivative on that product, then you get that this is eating, delta AB. So this thing is equal to I. Well, h bar is equal to 1, is equal to I times delta AB psi of x from this derivative acting on that. And then when it's acting on here, you just have that this is k canceling that. Okay, so the commutation relation is properly represented. So now we can ask, well, what about our new variables here? This thing is locked in place here. All right. So now we have phi hat of x. And we have pi hat of x prime. I'm suppressing the time variable now. And those guys are supposed to obey this commutator here, I delta 3 x minus x prime. Very similar to this. So what we can do then is, we can say, well, let's represent them as multiplication and differentiation again on some space of wave functionals. Now, I don't want to give it all away, and we are 2 minutes over the time. But please try it out. We will do that very soon. It's this exact thing is coming up. This is one way you can represent. You can mimic this business here and then get an explicit representation of those phi hat and those pi hat on a space of something that would be wave functions, but it's going to be wave functionals. But there are other ways too, completely different ways, and we will cover them all. OK? Any further questions? Try figuring this thing out yourself. Of course, you can look it up in the lecture notes too, but no, this stuff is not difficult. It's just a little bit abstract. It helps to just think it through yourself. Because as always with this abstract stuff, what can happen is that you read it through or listen to me explaining it and then just nod it through. It's just, yeah, yeah, that's plausible, that's plausible. But you only really get it if you try to reconstruct it yourself or even pre-construct it yourself before recovering. All right.